This is the Tanah Yukon Historical Society meeting, not a meeting, it's just a private talk here in my home with Jim Cassidy to help finish up the end of this tape. We feel we have come across some things in our work with the Pioneer Memorial Park that should be recorded for posterity in case that the printed matter is lost, and we are now going to record them on this tape. The first one is a history of the Manly Hot Springs Telephone Company. It comes about in this manner that Gus Benson has a very, very old-fashioned telephone switchboard at Manly Hot Springs, and during A67's activities to collect articles for the museum and for the Pioneer Memorial Park, this was offered to them, and they took it, and I guess Mr. Benson has made a very thorough research of the past history of the telephone company at Manly Hot Springs, and has put it in print and sent it to A67. Now, the switchboard, when first brought to my attention, was in a log cabin at A67, and apparently A67 had no specific place to install it for the show, and because the NC company had operated the telephone system, owned and operated it in Fairbanks for a number of years, I guess they thought it was appropriate to put this switchboard in the NC's trading post at the park. So we gladly accepted it and set it up, and Mr. Benson no doubt furnished A67 with this information, and we now have it in two plastic envelopes which we will hang by the switchboard. But as I said before, I want to record it here on tape for posterity in case the printed word is lost at some time, so I shall read it through. It starts, "A continual history of the Manly Hot Springs telephone system. Manly Hot Springs, Alaska, by Gus A. Benson, 1565. In the year about 1906, Charles E. Cavanaugh, an individual as owner, started up a telephone exchange in Manly, in parentheses, Hot Springs, Alaska, to be known as the Hot Springs Telephone Company. At some time between 1906 and 1910, Charles E. Cavanaugh, together with J.R. Frank, Pioneer Creek miner, strung telephone land lines from Hot Springs out to Eureka and Pioneer to serve the mining camps along these creeks and their tributaries. Telephones were installed, and thus by his investment and contribution, J.R. Frank became co-owner in the Hot Springs Telephone Company, with headquarters in Hot Springs Territory of Alaska. July the 2nd, 1910, pages 396 and 397, volume 2 of Deeds, Charles E. Cavanaugh sold his undivided one-half interest in the telephone company to Samuel D. Buck, B-U-C-K. September the 1st, 1912, page 5, volume 2 of Miscellaneous, Samuel D. Buck sold his one-half interest to Arthur Cavanaugh. October the 1st, 1914, pages 112 and 113, volume 2 of Miscellaneous, Arthur Cavanaugh sold his one-half interest back to Samuel D. Buck. August the 30th, 1917, pages 195 and 196, volume 2 of Miscellaneous, Samuel D. Buck sold his one-half interest to R. L. Stevens. August the 22nd, 1919, page 196 and 197, volume 2 of Miscellaneous, R. L. Stevens sold his one-half interest to Charles E. Cavanaugh. September the 17th, 1923, pages 236, volume 2 of Miscellaneous, Charles E. Cavanaugh sold his one-half interest to A.T. Rowe, R-O-W-E. November the 11th, 1927, page 259, volume 2, Miscellaneous, R.T. Rowe sold to Jenny Tillison. This transaction included one-half interest plus a half of the J.R. Frank interest, which comprised one-quarter interest in the company. Three-quarter interest in the telephone system was now vested in Mrs. Tillison. March the 25th, 1934, pages 414, volume 2, Miscellaneous, Jenny Tillison sold her undivided three-quarter interest in the Hot Springs telephone system to Gus A. Benson of Manly Hot Springs, Alaska. That concludes page 1. Page 2, May the 30th, 1945, pages 415, volume 2, Miscellaneous, Gus A. Benson purchased the balance from the remaining one-quarter interest in said telephone system and thus became the sole owner and operator of the Hot Springs Telephone Company. This was the only telephone service within or near Manly, parentheses, Hot Springs, the only one within the Manly Hot Springs recording district. With a switchboard in office in Manly Hot Springs, Alaska, and besides the local lines right here in town, the company telephone lines extended out, 1, easterly, approximately 6 miles to the mouth of Baker Creek on the Tanana River, where it connected with the government line up river to Tolovana, Minto, and Enana, 2, parentheses, northerly, approximately 23 miles to Eureka, and 4 miles beyond where it tied in with a government line to Rampart over the Yukon River, servicing the mining camps in the Rampart area. Besides the 7 miles or more of company line from Eureka easterly over to the mining camps on Pioneer Creek and its tributaries, the Hot Springs Telephone Company lines extended from Eureka westerly over to Glen, Rhode Island, Omega, and Thanksgiving Creeks, a distance of approximately 7 more miles. Also, at one time, a line ran from the overland at Baker Creek Road Bridge, roughly as Baker Creek runs down to its mouth on the Tanana River. 3, parentheses, from Hot Springs northwesterly, the company's lines went to Tofty, Woodchopper, American Creek, and Fish Lake, a distance of about 37 miles, where it connected with a government line downriver to Tanana, Ruby, Caltag, and on downriver. Also, a company line went from American Creek over to Big Boulder Creek, about 8 miles. 4, parentheses, westerly company line of Hot Springs, westerly company line out of Hot Springs, down the Hot Springs Slough to Kemperville, K-E-M-P-E-R-V-I-L-L-E, and on down the Tanana River to a point about 8 miles below Manly, parenthesis, Hot Springs. 5, parenthesis, southerly, a line from the switchboard to the Hot Springs steamboat landing on the Tanana River, about 3.5 miles. This telephone service has been a blessing indeed to its patrons over the years, as they can testify. When fires broke out here in town, the switchboard operator could have the necessary manpower on hand immediately. And when accidents occurred out at the mines by telephoning, they have been able to have an airplane land on their nearest airstrip within 30 minutes. Machinery and mining equipment breakdowns also expedited, saving time and dollars, a big item during the very short mining season Alaska affords. We have been able to save many lives by getting patients quickly to the hospital, an hour instead of days. It is sincerely hoped that this necessary and convenient public telephone service will always continue. December the 31st, 1963, Gus A. Benson sold the entire telephone system to Vilas, V-I-L-A-S, D. Marsh, and Elsie, E-L-S-I-E, M. Marsh, husband and wife of Manly Hot Springs, Alaska. And that concludes the write-up, furnished A67 with the telephone switchboard from Manly Hot Springs. Now we have another. This is entitled History, the Old NC Company Power House. And this comes to us through the son of... Oh dear, I better stop till I get these names. This is May the 25th, 1967, in Jim Cassidy's home on Slater Street in Fairbanks, and we have another recording that we think should be put on tape for posterity. This comes to us from Edgar Clausen's papers. Edgar Clausen of the NC Company passed away several years ago, and his son Cy Clausen, in going through his personal effects, came upon this and offered it to us. Now we feel this was written by Edgar Clausen, a longtime employee of the company, but we are not sure of any of these names, dates, or how it originated. But we put it down as it's printed here. History, Old NC Company Power House. In the winter of 1903-04, a 75 horsepower boiler and engine was installed by the company to furnish the new city with 1,000 electric lights and with steam heat. Everyone in town wanted to turn in their kerosene lamps, and by the summer of 1905, the NC installation, which had been intended originally as merely a sideline convenience for retail customers, was increased to the tremendous capacity of 240 horsepower and 3,000 electric lights. By May the 1st, 1905, the city's first fire pump was added to the steam plant, and to quote press of the time, it proved a godsend during the great fire of May the 22nd, 1906. Following the fire, the plant was again increased to 4,000 lights illuminating the city and boilers with engines of 400 horsepower. Public demand for the conveniences of steam heat and electricity was so out of hand by 1907, the Northern Commercial Company, with some $210,000 invested in the utilities plant, had to start a reconstruction program to enlarge their capacities. 6,000 electric lights were insufficient by this time. The 8 and 10 inch fire mains stretched throughout the city, and plans called for increasing the 3 inch sub mains to 5 inch mains. To the old equipment was added a long list of improvements. Two 150 horsepower tube boilers, two auxiliary boilers, engines and dynamos, parentheses direct current, of 125 horsepower each, and a mammoth water filtering tank possessing a capacity of 135,000 gallons for domestic purposes only. The utilities were a success to consumers and to owners, and during a half century since their installations were awarded to the company by franchise from the city of Fairbanks. Now that don't sound worded right to me. I'm going to read it over again. The utilities were a success to customers and to owners, and during the half century since their installation were awarded to the company by franchises from the city of Fairbanks. The last electric franchise was awarded in 1930, and in the summer of 1950, Fairbanks began to dispense its own city-operated electric power. The last franchise for the steam plant was awarded in 1931, and by this summer of 1952, the company is no longer in the utilities business at Fairbanks. Now, I presume that can be taken as 1952 is when Ed Clausen wrote this article. But to continue, page 2. When the steam plant, last of the original and marvelous modern plants, was turned over to the city in the summer of 1952, the company was supplying about 25% of Fairbanks with steam heat. The remaining residents heated homes and businesses by oil. But it still supplied all Fairbanks with the old-time signals 8 times a day. The whistle from the old company river packet Sarah on the St. Michael to Dawson run has told the time since 1915. That year it replaced the steam whistle brought up from San Francisco in 1904. For fire alarms, the whistle is replaced in these emergencies by a siren that first signaled such dangers in 1905. Fairbanks, with a newly completed electric power plant and with plans for an enlarged steam plant, can be proud of its own pride in the most modern city-owned utility system in the far north. 49 years earlier, both city and company were as proud of the company-owned marvels. Jessen's Weekly, remarking editorially in the summer of 1950, expressed the views of many of the city's residents. It is to be hoped that the Fairbanks Public Utilities will be able to give as good, if not better, service than the old reliable NC Company, and will be able to expand it according to their plans to meet the growing needs of the rapidly expanding city. Commendation is due the NC Company for the service it has given over the years at a reasonable charge. All wishes are extended to the Fairbanks Public Utilities System, which has taken over the problems as well as to assist, as well as the assets of the old NC business. And that concludes the history as written by Edgar Clausen of the old NC Company Powerhouse. Now, one or two personal remarks by myself. All of us old-timers can well remember the old steam siren that would screech and scream to high heaven whenever there was a fire alarm. And it would raise strangers' hats right off their head if they were walking downtown anywhere close to the powerhouse. So after the city started their own powerhouse, the NC powerhouse sat there for a couple of years and then was torn down, and a great deal of it was bought by the Centrana Mining Company and shipped down there. And it lay down there in a big pile, and not all of it was reassembled down there. And my work as service man with the NC Company took me down there several times, and in the later years after I was interested with the Tanana Historical Society and the Pioneer of the Park, I have attempted to locate this old steam siren and to bring it back to Fairbanks. I'd love to set it up out on the city or the FE Company's powerhouse and let that old siren screech some New Year's night. It would make every old timer really smile, because I notice here it says the whistle from the old company river packet Sarah on the St. Michael to Dawson run has told the time since 1915. That year it replaced the steam whistle brought up from San Francisco in 1904. For fire alarms, the whistle is replaced in these emergencies by a siren that first signaled such dangers in 1905. So this old steam siren was very familiar with everybody that was ever in Fairbanks from 1905 to 1952, and that alone made quite a treasure out of it. I have attempted several times to locate it among the pipe fittings and spare parts laying around in the mud down at the mouth of the old Centrana mine, but have been unable to do so to the present time. And this concludes our history as recorded on this tape. We have one more, if we can locate it, which is supposed to be the history of the Fairbanks Curling Club. Maybe we have enough tape to get it on here too, but we will do that later. Here is another history that we'd like to put on tape. I'll run off the end of the tape and have to reverse before this one is over with. But this one is written by, and in his own personal signature, C.W. Adams, and he was the captain, I think, of this boat for the NC Company. It commences November the 1st, 1948, to whom it may concern. And this is written by Mr. Adams, as I stated, from his memories of contacts in the early days. It starts out, in July 1901, at St. Michael, Captain Barnett had a small stern-wheel steamer with which he intended to take a large stock of goods up the Tanana River and start a trading post. While moving around the bay, he struck a rock with his steamer and it sunk. I think it was called the Arctic Boy. Anyway, he was unable to do anything with it. At that time, we were there with the steamer Laval Young, and Captain Barnett came over to see me about taking his supplies up the Tanana River to Tanana Crossing. Now, none of us had ever been up the Tanana River, but I heard that Captain Patterson had been up there with a small launch bringing log rafts down for the U.S. Army at Fort Weare, W-E-A-R-E, which is now called Tanana. Captain Peterson was in St. Michael at the time, and I went to see him. And he told me that the Laval Young could not go up the Tanana farther than the mouth of Chena Slough. He also gave me the names of two pilots that I could get at Fort Weare. I then told Captain Barnett that it was very doubtful if we could get beyond Chena Slough, and after some talk we made up a contract whereby we agreed to take him to the slough for so much a ton, and if possible to take him and his outfit of 130 tons to Tanana Crossing for an additional sum per ton. It was also agreed that if we got beyond Chena Slough and could get no farther, that Barnett would get off with his goods wherever that happened to be. And now I better reverse this film, I'm too near the end. We start the second half of this tape by continuing the story. The last remark was wherever it happened to be. And so we took his goods aboard, including Mrs. Barnett, Mr. Smith, parenthesis, who was some kind of a partner, and three men. In the outfit, he also had a dog team and a horse. We left St. Michael about the 8th of August and had no trouble reaching Fort Weare near the mouth of Tanana. And there we got the two pilots. In going up the Tanana, we had to cut our own wood for the boiler, stopping every evening when we saw some dry trees. We finally passed the mouth of Chena Slough, and a mile or so above, Hendricks and Belt had a trading post. Now, to comment on the side, I have found, been unable to locate anybody that can tell me about this Hendrick, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S, and Belt, B-E-L-T, had a trading post. I've never heard anyone in the histories of these early days mention these two men having a trading post on the Tanana, a short distance above the mouth of Chena Slough, to verify what this article states. Now, to continue, and I'm going to repeat that last sentence, because this is written by Mr. C.W. Adams, who was captain of the boat. We finally passed the mouth of Chena Slough, and a mile or so above, Hendricks and Belt had a trading post. We went on up 6 or 8 miles and came to where the river was all scattered out in a lot of channels, none of which were deep enough for us. The Laval Young was not a light draft steamer, and we did not have steam gear, steam steering gear, or a steam capstan, which is nothing but a winch. After trying all channels, our captain, I think his name was Fredericks, he means his pilot, told me it was impossible to go farther, and Captain Barnett agreed with him. Captain Barnett then told me that an Indian had told him that perhaps we could go up the Chena Slough and get out into the Tanana above this bad place and go on up to the crossing. This we decided to do, and we went back and started up the slough and reached a point about 6 miles above where Fairbanks now is, and here we could get no farther. This was just before noon, and we tied up. I told Barnett that according to the contract he should get off here, but he wanted me to take him down to the mouth of the slough. Now going downstream is very much more difficult than going up, and I figured we would perhaps get stuck a few times, and so we would not agree to take him that far unless he would pay us for the time lost while stuck. He also figured we would get stuck on a bar perhaps more than once and refused. We were in the pilot house alone, and after an hour or so of debate, he said that he had noticed a nice, high, heavily wooded bank about 6 miles below and asked me to take him there, and I agreed to do so. On the way down, we got stuck twice, but not bad, and finally tied up about 4 o'clock. Right where the NC Company store now stands in the town of Fairbanks. This was August the 26th, 1901. 3 months before this speaker was born. At 5 p.m., we tied up at 4 p.m., Angus McDougall, A-N-G-U-S, McDougall, a deckhand, cut the first tree down, which was leaning over the deck and close to the pilot house. The second tree was cut by Shorty Robinson, and the third by Soapy Smith II. So there you have the first three trees that were cut in Fairbanks. We had to clear a space in the timber to pile Barnett's goods ashore, and also so he could erect some large tents. The second day, while unloading, two prospectors came along, said they were prospecting on a creek which later turned out to be Gold Stream, or a branch of it. They bought some bacon and things from Barnett, and they also showed us some gold dust, just a little from where they were prospecting. Then they went back, and one of these men was Felix Pedro. The next morning, our Jap cook, after drinking a lot of something besides water, fell overboard. He was a good swimmer and got out all right. It looked very bad for Captain Barnett to be put off there and no Indians or anyone else to trade with. Just before we left, one of our deckhands, Dan McCarthy, came to me and said he would like to stay and that one of Barnett's men would take his place, so I paid Dan and took the other man. Dan later found a good claim, he and his father, I believe. Mrs. Barnett was crying when we left the next day, as it did not look good to her either. These pages separated. Captain Barnett was quite angry with us because I would not take him to the mouth of the slough, but later that winter I saw him in Dawson on his way outside, and he was all smiles and told me I could not have put him off in a better place. Signed, C.W. Adams. And there's the date, November the 1st, 1948. That's apparently the date when this was written by Mr. Adams. And this article again comes to us through Cy Clawson from his father's, Edgar Clawson's, personal papers. And that concludes this article. Here is another long two-page one, I believe comes from the same source. And at the same time, the name is History of the Northern Commercial Company. The real origin of the company was in 1791 when a trading post was established at Unalaska, or Unalaska, by two Russians doing business as the Golkin Shilkov, G-O-L-K-I-V, Golkiv, S-H-E-L-I-K-O-V company, which was a subsidiary of the Imperial Russian Crown. A second branch was opened some 5 years later at Kodiak, and the organization slowly grew from there until in 1867, as the Russian-American Fur Company, it had a large number of posts extending from Sitka and southeast to many points on the Bering Sea, the center of its activities being in the Kodiak Cook Inlet areas. The Russian-American Fur Company reached the peak of its development under Alexander Baranov, whose name was well known to Alaskans. When the United States purchased Alaska and the Aleutian Islands from the Russians in 1867, a syndicate of San Franciscans was formed to take over the operation of the Russian-American Fur Company, which was, in one sense, a commercial venture of the Imperial Russian government, and which, therefore, could not continue as such under the American flag. This syndicate was known as Hutchison Kohl, K-O-H-L, and Company. In January the 31st, 1868, the Alaska Commercial Company was formed, and they took over the assets of Hutchison and Coal Company. In January of 1901, plans were made for merging the various commercial and transportation interests on the Yukon, the various firms being the Alaska Commercial Company, Alaska Exploration Company, the Empire Transportation Company, and the newly organized firm purchased the business of the Seattle Yukon Transportation Company, together with their various boats and barges. The new organization began business on May the 1st, 1901. The Northern Commercial Company handling all of the commercial business, and the Northern Navigation Company, the transportation end of the merge. Northern Navigation Company sold its vessels and equipment to the White Pass and Yukon route in 1914. The Alaska Commercial Company retained a few small posts and other interests as late as 1940 and went out of existence as a cooperation on December the 31st, 1941. The present owners of the Northern Commercial Company purchased the business January the 1st, 1922 from the Alaska Commercial Company, the group being headed by Mr. Volney Richmond Sr., who for many years had been general superintendent of the earlier Northern Commercial Company. The company at the present time, either through direct ownership or through its Canadian subsidiary, operates from 30 branches in Alaska and the Yukon Territory. The real origin of the company was in 1791 when a trading post was established at Unalaska by two Russians doing business. Uh-oh, that's the second page, and it's the same as the first. So you would see, there's three copies of it here. So it's only one page long instead of two. And it ends up with the company at the present time, either through direct ownership or through its Canadian subsidiary, operates from 30 branches in Alaska and the Yukon Territory. And that finishes the history of the Northern Commercial Company. Here is one more that I'm going to record on this tape as long as this particular tape is being used for that purpose. Now this is in freehand writing, and it's a heavy point pen and a little hard to read, and there's no date so far that I can see, but I'm going to struggle through it. It's entitled The History of the Fairbanks Curling Club. Curling commenced in Fairbanks in the winter of 1905, mainly by men that came to Fairbanks from Dawson and the Yukon. During 1905 and 1906, the curling games were played on the Northern Commercial Company's dock, located on the river bank in front of the present location of the NC Company store. This dock was about 60 feet wide and reached from Barnett Street to Turner. Exhibition games were played in the open on the river ice during the spring months, when the weather was pleasant and the ice suitable. During the winter of 1907 and 8, curling was carried on the river ice in a big tent located on the hospital side of the river and directly above the location of the present bridge. The curling games were played here until sometime in early March, when a strong wind completely demolished the tent and ended curling activities for that year. During the summer of 1908, the present curling rink was built on ground purchased from the city, located on 2nd Avenue between Cowles and Wickersham Street. The early day curlers paid considerable more for the privilege of curling than it costs today. The dues ran from $100 to $200 for the season, depending on the amount of money required to carry on the activities for the season. And there's some printing on the side that I can't identify. The second page. Curling is played on a sheet of smooth, level ice with a series of circles at each end. These circles are 12 feet in diameter. The rink is 135. The length of the rink from back to back is 135 feet. The circles consist of 3 2-foot rings within a 2-foot diameter button in the center. The game is played with 4 men to a team. A team consists of a skip who manages the team, a third who manages the rink during the time the skip throws his rocks, and a second and a lead who throws his first rock. Each man throws 2 rocks. The lead starts the game with the first rock, followed by the opposing lead with 1 rock, and so on through the game. 10 ends are played, lasting about 2 hours. The object of the game is to get as many, the object of the game is to get as many rocks as possible closer to the button or target than the opposing team. Guards are laid to protect a person's rock that is counting. Brooms are used on a slow-moving rock. By hard sweeping, the ice is polished and cleared of any dirt or straw that might slow up a rock, and oftentimes a rock will travel 12 to 15 feet by good sweeping that otherwise would stop within the distance. Our curling stones weigh from 36 to 45 pounds, and we understand that most curling rocks are today standardized on the 40-pound rocks. Hard to get these pages apart. All the present curling stones are hand-cut. The club were... can't read it. All the present curling stones on hand at the club were purchased from Scotland and were paid for by members of the early day club. These stones cost on the average of $75 per pair, and the rink owns presently about 26 pairs of matching stones. The rink just this week received a shipment of 6 dozen special curling brooms. These brooms were manufactured in Superior, Wisconsin, in a section of the United States that is curling conscious. This curling broom is a special broom manufactured especially for curling and has long straws and a short handle. During the early days and for many succeeding years, the membership of the curling club averaged about 32 members. This membership has grown during recent years to a present membership of 96 members, which is the limit that the present curling club building can accommodate. The membership dues are $10 per person per month. Curling used to be considered a game for the only elderly people, and it was never considered of a suitable game for women. Today, this has all changed, and younger people, including boys, women, and girls, make ardent and excellent curlers. Present officers for the 1952, there's their first date. Present officers for the 1952-53 season are Grover McCarty, president, Alaska Link, vice president, Cynthia Lilly, secretary, board of directors, of which there are 5, Peter Gatz, Al Johnson, Charles Clasby, Alaska Link, and Grover McCarty. And the last page is short. During the summer just past, the east wall, wooden wall, was removed and replaced with concrete blocks at the cost of $4,500. The club hopes to raise enough money so that the west wall and ends can also be removed and replaced with concrete blocks. We also plan to have a clubhouse on a portion of the second floor. A considerable amount of money was saved on the improvements job because a lot of the work was done by members of the club. And I believe this was written by, now I don't rightfully know who. I thought it was Grover McCarty because his name is the last one on here, but I see that his name just accidentally is one of the five directors and happens to be the last one to sign. So whether Grover actually wrote this up or not, I do not know. But in closing, I have the thought of taking this down to the Curling Club and getting them to type this up. There's a lot of little notes along the margin of these letters that can't be interpreted that I had to leave out. And the present Curling Club has quite a history where this left off, and I think it should all be included in it. So I'm going to try and get someone in the Curling Club to bring this article up to date, and we will try and put it on this same tape. And that is all for today.